Israel cannot survive if it becomes a pariah.
Thank you, Senator. I realize that wasn't easy.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening convenience on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. All the news you need and maybe some that you don't in just under an hour. Welcome to it. So I realize, simply based on the sound here, Desi Doyen, hi.
Hi.
This may not sound like much, but in truth, as Joe Biden would say, this is a big effing deal. This is Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York on the floor of the U.S. Senate on Thursday.
I have known Prime Minister Netanyahu for a very long time. While we have vehemently disagreed on many occasions, I will always respect his extraordinary bravery for Israel on the battlefield as a younger man. I believe in his heart he has his highest priority is the security of Israel. However, I also believe Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way by allowing his political survival to take the precedence over the best interests of Israel. He has put himself in coalition with far-right extremists like Ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, and as a result, he has been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for Israel worldwide to historic lows. Israel cannot survive if it becomes a pariah. As a lifelong supporter of Israel, it has become clear to me the Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then, and the Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past. At this critical juncture, I believe a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel, at a time when so many Israelis have lost their confidence in the vision and direction of their government. Hamas and the Palestinians who support and tolerate their evil ways, radical right-wing Israelis in government and society, President Abbas, Prime Minister Netanyahu. These are the four obstacles to peace. And if we fail to overcome them, then Israel and the West Bank and Gaza will be trapped in the same violent state of affairs they've experienced for the last 75 years.
That was Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on Thursday calling on Israel to hold new elections, saying he believes Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has, quote, lost his way and is an obstacle to peace in the region amid a growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Schumer, the first Jewish majority leader in the Senate and the highest-ranking Jewish official in the U.S., who, by the way, comes from New York City, the city with the largest Jewish population in the world, including larger than Jerusalem, larger than Tel Aviv. So, yes, this is a big effing deal. Schumer strongly criticized Netanyahu in a 40-minute speech on Thursday morning on the Senate floor, from which we just played about 2 minutes for you. He accurately pointed out that Netanyahu has put himself in a coalition of far-right extremists and, quote, as a result, he has been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for Israel worldwide to historic lows. And while I will quibble with Schumer on one point there, Netanyahu has not tolerated the civilian toll. He has actually caused it without hesitation.
Agreed.
Since Hamas's horrific attack on Israel on October 7. But Schumer is a politician. He's balancing and challenging many constituencies and political roles in his remarks there. I am not. So I've got a lot more leeway in what I say. In any event, said Schumer very correctly, Israel cannot survive if it becomes a pariah. And this is me, but echoing Schumer here, the longer the very unpopular in Israel Netanyahu stays in power in Israel, the longer the war is going to continue. And the more Israel will become the world's pariah, as he says. And I say these things, as I believe Schumer does, because I believe that Israel has the right to exist and defend itself. And indeed, it needs to exist and defend itself, but not like this. And it won't exist, or at least it will be in a perpetual state of war, if it continues down the path that it has been on since October 7. That is the same sentiment that Schumer was trying to make clear in his call for new elections in Israel. As AP notes, many Israelis hold Netanyahu responsible for failing to stop the October 7 cross-border raid by Hamas. But remember, Netanyahu is facing several criminal felony charges himself for various forms of corruption in Israel, but he won't face those charges in court, if ever, until he is out of office. And he's made clear that he has no interest in calling for elections until the war on Gaza is complete, whatever that means. And therefore, why would the war on Gaza ever be complete? If Netanyahu's very ticket for staying out of prison remains his ability to remain as the prime minister of Israel, which, as Netanyahu has said, will not hold new elections until the war is over, well, you see how this works? He'll be prime minister forever, and the war will continue forever. And by the way, if that construct of holding power by any means necessary in order to avoid accountability for criminal felonies, if that echoes to you here at home watching this year's presidential election in the U.S., well, good, because it absolutely should. Anyway, back to AP here. The high-level warning from Schumer comes as an increasing number of Democrats have pushed back against Israel and as President Joe Biden has stepped up public pressure on Netanyahu's government. The U.S. this month began airdrops of badly needed humanitarian aid and announced it will establish a temporary pier to get more assistance into Gaza via the sea. Of course, the notion that the U.S. can't get humanitarian aid to a population that is starving, that desperately needs it, other than via airdrops and by building a temporary pier out on the sea that will take 2 months to build because our ally, supposed ally in Benjamin Netanyahu's government in Israel is preventing us from delivering that humanitarian aid, that is in itself obscene and absurd. Schumer has long positioned himself as a strong ally of the Israeli government. In fact, he was one of very few Democrats who allied with Netanyahu to oppose the Obama administration's nuclear deal with Iran. I believe there was only four Democratic senators at the time. Schumer was one of them. Just to help you understand what a big effing deal it is for Chuck Schumer, of all people, to call for new elections in Israel. He visited Israel just days after the October 7 attack by Hamas. He gave a lengthy speech on the Senate floor back in December decrying, quote, brazen and widespread anti-Semitism, the likes of which we haven't seen in generations in this country, if ever. Schumer says Netanyahu, who has long opposed Palestinian statehood, is one of several obstacles in the way of the two-state solution pushed by the United States, and that Netanyahu, quote, has lost his way by allowing his political survival to take precedence over the best interests of Israel, and I couldn't agree more. The U.S., of course, cannot dictate the outcome of an election in Israel, as Schumer said, but, quote, a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel at a time when so many Israelis have lost their confidence in the vision and direction of their government. Schumer said that as the highest-ranking Jewish elected official in the United States. He said he feels an obligation to speak out. He said his last name derives from the Hebrew word shomer, or guardian, noting, quote, I also feel very keenly my responsibility as shomer Israel, a guardian of the people of Israel, he said. Democratic Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii, who is also Jewish, praised Schumer's remarks. He said, quote, this is a gutsy, historic speech from leader Schumer. On Twitter, on Thursday, in response to that speech, he said, I know he didn't arrive at this conclusion casually or painlessly. At the White House, the national security spokesperson, John Kirby, declined to weigh in on Schumer's call for new elections, saying the White House is most focused on getting a temporary ceasefire in place. But as TPM's Josh Marshall, a longtime deep dive follower of Israeli politics and history, as Josh writes, Schumer is unquestionably taking this step in coordination with the White House. He's putting himself forward as a heat shield for Joe Biden, but it also clearly took on an almost adamantine level of frustration and anger at Netanyahu to bring Schumer to this point. Marshall said, I have no doubt that Schumer believes every word he is saying. It's a step that is an important one for U.S.-Israeli relations generally, and also for American supporters of Israel generally. And not that you ask, but I agree. Republicans, of course, are already pretending to be outraged by Schumer's remarks, but of course, that's what they do, and if they want to have the blood on their hands of a mass atrocity, that is up to them. Those like Schumer, frankly, who have the guts here to try and change this already horrific and unsustainable course should be applauded, in my opinion, because, yes, it is a big and long overdue effing deal.
I agree. And it also means more, I think, coming from Schumer. It's a big deal coming from Schumer because he's Jewish. And as you had noted, the representative of the New York State, which is the largest population of Jewish people in the world. He has a bit more moral authority in coming out and saying this, although it's taken way too long, in my opinion.
I hear you. So that'll be interesting to watch moving forward in what I believe is far less of a big effing deal. Congress and the media sure are enjoying making a big deal out of this. TikTok, the social media service that, frankly, I couldn't care less about. But that said, you may have heard there's a big move in recent days in Congress, supported by big majorities on both sides of the aisle. Maybe that's why the media loves covering it. So a big push to pass a bill that would ban the TikTok app entirely in the United States if its China-linked owner ByteDance doesn't sell it off or isn't sold itself to an independent company, independent of the Chinese government in any event, in 6 months' time after the bill is signed into law. Now, the House overwhelmingly passed the bill this week, though its future in the Senate is less certain at the moment, especially since Donald Trump, after actually banning or trying to ban TikTok by executive order himself during his presidency, a ban that was found to be unconstitutional by the courts and thus struck down, after previously actually trying to ban TikTok himself during his presidency, this week Donald Trump, who is desperate for cash to cover his legal bills and more than $500 million that he now owes in New York for civil fraud, rape, defamation rulings against him, suddenly Donald Trump is in favor of TikTok. He doesn't want to ban it. Thinks it should stick around. He said this week that he doesn't want to see them banned because it would only make Facebook stronger somehow. Conveniently, his TikTok flip-flop came just hours, apparently, after meeting with a billionaire who owns billions of dollars of shares in ByteDance, apparently. So, as usual, a wildly corrupt position from Donald Trump and a completely transactional one, making clear that he is now fully for sale to anyone who may be able to help him raise some desperately needed cash. Need me to change a position? Just let me know. Got money? Come on in. So, you know, those always BS claims that he was just so rich he couldn't be bought. Remember those from 2016 that he repeated over and over again? It was always BS, of course, but now it is transparently BS. But I offer this with the caveat that I really have not dug deeply into this story and the pros and cons of the bill and what the House is trying to do, what they overwhelmingly passed that could end up banning TikTok if the company that owns it isn't sold. But I am deeply troubled by the idea of banning any such social media outlet, first on free speech grounds, that alone. Second, on China bashing grounds. Oh, it's those evil Chinese. We got to get rid of this thing. They're tracking our people, and who knows what they're doing with all that data. But mostly on the notion that somehow TikTok is any worse, is any more dangerous than any other social media service, like, for example, Twitter. Oh, I'm sorry, X. Now owned and controlled with an iron fist by Elon Musk. Or Facebook, owned by Zuckerberg, which helped Trump in his 2016 election in the first place, or any other such service. This notion that we should be concerned only about China somehow influencing Americans through what is shown to them on TikTok is, well, the idea that that's any worse than Elon Musk or Zuckerberg's ability to do the exact same thing on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, that seems absurd to me. Again, maybe I haven't seen enough, I haven't read enough about this. Maybe there's something I misunderstand. If so, if you think so, let me know. I'd love to hear from you via email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. But sorry, I just don't get it. Want to force these companies to be more transparent in what they do and the data that they use, where they keep it, what they do with it, who they sell it to, what algorithms they use to determine what is and isn't shown to people? Fine, pass that law, a law that does that for all of them. I have no problem with that. I'd support such a law. But somehow penalizing just one of them under the premise that they're tied to scary China, but that the site owned by Elon frickin' Musk, that's just fine? Nope, it's not fine. Having trouble getting on board for that.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, it seems like Congress should be treating all of the social media companies the same way, not singling one out, as you said. I mean, I'm so old that I remember way back when privacy standards, basic privacy internet standards were being discussed in Congress, and they were blocked after intense lobbying from social media companies. And Europe managed to pass them. If they were able to pass them now, that might go a long way towards solving the problem.
Do it here. That's fine. Regulate them. Make them be more transparent. I would have no problem with that. But just one of them? Just TikTok? Really? Anyway, for those who might support that idea, we have this today. Donald Trump's former secretary, Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, said on Thursday that he will put together an investor group to buy TikTok after the House passed a bill that would ban the popular video app in the U.S. if its China-based owner does not sell its stake. So there you go. People, be careful what you wish for. During an interview on CNBC's Squawk Box, Mnuchin said he had spoken, quote, to a bunch of people about creating an investor group that would purchase the popular social media company. He offered no details about who may be in that group or about TikTok's possible valuation. Quote, this should be owned by U.S. businesses, Mnuchin said. There's no way that the Chinese would ever let a U.S. company own something like that in China. Okay, so you Democrats out there supporting this bill, how do you feel about it now? Do you feel better knowing that Steve Mnuchin and his private investor pals will have control of this app if they're allowed to buy it versus China? You think that's a good thing? Having Musk and Zuckerberg and Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary running the three biggest social media apps in America?
In an election year?
In an election year? Really? Again, am I missing something here? What am I missing? TikTok, for the record, has long denied that it could be used as a tool of Chinese authorities. The company insists it has never shared U.S. user data with the Chinese government and will not do so if asked. To date, the U.S. government has also not provided evidence that shows TikTok shared such information with authorities in China, though a lot of Democrats out there and Republicans claiming that they have, that it's all true, that the owners of TikTok are lying about the data. Though they haven't showed any evidence to support that, at least that I know of. Maybe you've seen it. Let me know. Bradcast@bradblog.com. The White House had no immediate reaction on Thursday to Mnuchin's potential bid for TikTok, though it has previously said that Joe Biden would sign this bill if it reached his desk. Hey, is that still the case today, White House? Just curious. By the way, when Trump tried to ban TikTok back in 2020, Mnuchin was still his Treasury Secretary. So the guy from the administration who wanted to ban it before now wants to buy it. And if all of this does not smell right to you, I join you in smelling no small amount of stench around all of this, and I'm hoping the Democrats wake up. All right. One more story. That stinks to high heaven today.
A lot of stinky stuff today.
I know. Before we get to a break here, you remember that guy, Alexander Smirnov, who was the supposed FBI informant who blew the whistle on Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden receiving $5 million each in bribes from a Ukrainian energy company named Burisma. Those claims that were at the center of years of Republican charges and at the very center of the House GOP's, I guess, still ongoing attempt to impeach Joe Biden. Is that still going on? I think it is. In any event, that guy just a couple of weeks ago was actually arrested and indicted by the DOJ. The guy who was the source of all of these claims about Hunter and Joe Biden. He was arrested and indicted by the Department of Justice for giving false information to government officials about all of this. The supposedly FBI informant gave this bad information to the FBI. And prosecutors argue in their charging documents that he had actually received this false information in the first place about bribes to the Bidens from Burisma, from top Russian intelligence agents. So the information went from Russian intelligence agencies to the FBI, to the Republicans in the U.S. House who were trying to use this to impeach a Democratic president. Got it? So that guy, remember that guy in that story? Well, we got a little bit more to add to it today from the UK's Guardian, which frankly may not surprise you at all. They write, an American company that paid the now indicted FBI informant Alexander Smirnoff in 2020, yes, in an election year, is connected to a UK company owned by a Trump business associate in Dubai, that according to business filings and court documents. Now, I'm not a fan of these sort of, you know, guilt by association stories that we hear a lot on the right and the left, claiming that, oh, such and such once worked for the brother of a guy whose cousin worked in a law firm where one of the former partners once served as a law clerk for a judge who dismissed a case against company owned by that guy. You get the picture. I don't like those stories much. But in this case, the connections here are pretty direct. Smirnoff, as The Guardian explains, is now accused of lying to the FBI about Hunter Biden and his father, President Joe Biden, alleging that they engaged in a bribery scheme. Smirnoff's accounts to the FBI beginning in 2020, again, the election year, coincidentally enough, when Donald Trump was running for president. Smirnoff's accounts to the FBI began in 2020 that federal prosecutors now say are fabrications served as the major justification of the House impeachment investigation into the Bidens. Republican lawmakers have repeatedly touted Smirnoff as a reliable informant, and the chair of the House Oversight Committee, James Comer, even threatened to hold the FBI director, Christopher Wray, in contempt unless he handed over a June 2020 FBI form that Smirnoff's claims to the committee. So somehow or another, James Comer knew about this interview with the FBI by this guy and was demanding that the FBI release that information so that the House GOP could use it publicly. And if they didn't, they would hold the FBI director, Christopher Wray, in contempt. Christopher Wray, by the way, appointed by Donald Trump. So that would be what the Republicans for months and months, maybe years at this point, had been trying to get. Well, as The Guardian reports, back in 2020, Smirnoff was paid $600,000 by a company called Economic Transformation Technologies, or ETT, according to prosecutors. That same year, Smirnoff began lying to the FBI about the Bidens, according to the indictment, the year that he got that $600,000 from this company named ETT. ETT's CEO is the American Christopher Condon, who is also one of three shareholders in ETT Investment Holding Limited in London, essentially the parent company of ETT here in the U.S. The other two shareholders in the U.K. are Pakistani-American investor Shahal Khan and Farooq Arjumand, a former chair and current board member of Damac Properties in Dubai, who is also listed as an advisor on ETT's American site. So not a lot of people here, about three people so far and three different companies, ETT, which is owned by ETT Investment Holdings, which is owned by people who are on the board of Damac Properties in Dubai. The exact business model of Texas-based ETT is murky, the media outlet Guardian notes. Its mission statement reads in part, quote, ETT set up the chessboard to bring in top-notch executives from those sectors to help implement its vision of love and social impact to improve the quality of human existence through the application of new age technologies.
We're not at all money laundering here. It's really just very pretty, like we just said.
Doesn't sound made up or totally fishy at all, does it? So the current CEO of ETT, Christopher Condon, has been involved apparently in several civil lawsuits, including a civil RICO case back in 2010. He won that one on appeal. His official biography says he is, quote, a former professional tennis player, financial advisor, and currently is an entrepreneur focused on social impact projects, public-private partnerships, and creating smart communities that benefit both individuals and government. Whatever. Condon, Argemond, and Kahn, they're the three shareholders in ETT and its parent company. They registered that parent company in the UK on March 6th of 2020. That would be just before Smirnoff would have been paid $600,000 and tipped off the FBI about these false bribery claims regarding the Bidens. Kahn, an investor who purchased the Plaza Hotel in 2018, which was once owned by Donald Trump, and Argemond, both of them have ties to Donald Trump through a major Middle East developer company named Damac that has partnered with Trump. That company has partnered with Trump for a decade. Argemond, Kahn, and Condon own essentially a third each of ETT Investment Holding in the UK. According to the business filings there, no other information on the UK company is readily available. The former chair of Damac, Hussein Sajwani, is also close to Donald Trump, has been described as his friend in multiple news reports. Trump has called the billionaire a friend and a, quote, great man, and his family, quote, the most beautiful people. That's what Trump says about this guy. He attended Trump's 2016 inauguration. Trump's sons, Don Jr. and Eric, attended the 2017 ribbon cutting of the Trump International Golf Club in Dubai that was licensed by Damac in 2014. Sajwani and his family also attended a party in 2017 at Mar-a-Lago. Trump's sons would go on to attend Sajwani's daughter's wedding in 2018. So these are very close, very close connections to these people. To these people who paid $600,000 in 2020 to a guy tied to Russian intelligence that just happened to give false claims about Joe Biden to the FBI. Pretty direct, actually. And there is much more in the Guardian story. I'll link to it when I post today's show at bradblog.com of, you know, about others who are closely tied to the Trumps in all of this. But the central takeaway here, for me at least, is that the guy who gave false information to the FBI in 2020 that is tied to Russian intelligence that the House GOP somehow knew about and insisted the FBI release their records about their interview with him, is not only tied to Russian intelligence, but was paid some $600,000 around the exact same time by very close business associates of Donald Trump. And by the way, as The Guardian reports, ETT Investment Holdings Limited in the UK was then dissolved in 2021.
Wow, that was fast.
Mission accomplished. So I suspect we will see more on this as the Smirnoff case moves forward, but I did think it was worth putting on your radar today. It's an unbelievable bit of detail just sort of coming to light in this story, which frankly, disturbingly, isn't unbelievable in the least as I see it. Let's take a quick break here. We've got some more Donald Trump accountability-related news for you still ahead today. Some still breaking because there is always more. And because there is always Desi Doyen, we will have our latest Green News Report for you today with some kind of incredible stuff happening down in Florida, where there's always incredible stuff going on in Ron DeSantis' corrupt state government.
True.
All of that somehow is straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Someone is going to jail, seemingly very soonly, that we'll get to in this block in a moment. That's right. But we have this breaking just as in our last block here. The federal judge overseeing President Donald J. Trump's prosecution on charges of mishandling classified documents, I would say stealing, on Thursday rejected one of his motions seeking to have the case dismissed, the first time she has denied a legal attack on the indictment by Donald Trump. In a two-page order, the judge, Aileen M. Cannon, rebuffed arguments by Trump's lawyers that the central statute in the indictment, the Espionage Act, was impermissibly vague and should be struck down entirely. That after Trump himself showed up in court for a day-long hearing down in Fort Pierce, Florida, in federal district court, where she entertained a number of arguments from Trump's legal team and from prosecutors in the office of the special counsel Jack Smith about the Espionage Act. So Donald Trump lost that one for now. Nonetheless, she has been slow walking that case, so don't get too excited about it.
No, but at least it's a sign that she's not like so completely in the tank that it's egregious more so than we already thought.
Maybe. We'll see if that's I'm not so certain. All right, and so you know that one criminal case of the four that Donald Trump is currently facing, the one that wasn't delayed, the one in New York, New York State, New York City, related to his 2016 hush money paid to a porn star to help him cheat to win the 2016 presidential election, the one that was supposed to begin its jury selection for its trial on March 25. Yeah, well, that one may now also have to be delayed. Less than 2 weeks before Trump was set to go on trial on criminal charges in Manhattan, according to the New York Times, the prosecutors who brought the case proposed a delay of up to 30 days. That, according to the Times this afternoon, which describes it as a startling development in the first prosecution of a former American president. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office, which accused Trump of covering up a sex scandal during and after the 2016 presidential campaign, said the delay would give Trump's lawyers time to review a new batch of records, which the office sought more than a year ago, but only recently received them from federal prosecutors who years ago invested the hush money payments at the center of the case themselves as they relate to Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen. In response to the new records, apparently tens of thousands of pages of them, Trump's lawyers requested that the trial be delayed 90 days, 3 months. Although the former president frequently requests such delays, prosecutors consenting to any postponement, as they seem to be consenting to not 90 but 30 days, any consent from them makes such a delay far more likely, New York Times says. In a court filing, the district attorney, Alvin Bragg, said his prosecutors were prepared to begin the trial on March 25 as planned, but that they did not oppose a 30-day delay, quote, out of an abundance of caution and to ensure that defendant has sufficient time to review these new materials. They're not really new materials. They're old materials from years ago, but they finally received them from the feds for the first time just days ago. The judge overseeing the case, Juan Merchan, would have to approve any delay here, and it remains unclear how and when he will rule. He has made a point of pushing the case forward at every turn so far. Now, I'm sure many others will be all over this one today and tonight, and frankly for the next month if the trial doesn't begin as previously planned in just over a week's time. But from the Manhattan prosecutors pleading here, they explain, in part, quote, "We note that the timing of the current production of additional materials from the U.S. Attorney's Office is a function of defendant's own delay. The people," that would be New York, "diligently sought the full grand jury record related to Michael Cohen's campaign finance convictions from the U.S. Attorney's Office last year. In response, the office produced a subset of the material that we requested, which we timely and fully disclosed to the defendant on June 8, 2023, last year.
Yeah, back in June. Okay.
More than 9 months ago. They continue, despite having access to those materials since June, defendant raised no concerns to the people about the sufficiency of our efforts to obtain materials from the U.S. Attorney's Office until last week. So they knew exactly what it was that they had requested from the U.S. Attorney. They knew what they received from the U.S. Attorney because it was shared with Team Trump. Last year, 9 months ago, and only last week did they say, yeah, you know what, we think there's more that we want. And, well, they waited until January 18 of 24 to subpoena additional materials from the U.S. attorney and then consented to repeated extensions of the deadline for the U.S. Attorney's Office's determination about this. The timing of the office's production is a result solely of defendant's delay despite the people's diligence. In other words, they said, yeah, we're not in a rush. Take your time. So, yeah, another successful delay tactic from Team Trump, it seems. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see. Mershon has not yet ruled. But in any event, you know what? We were planning on taking a spring break over the week of March 25 anyway. So perhaps this means we won't miss a single day of that trial, Des.
Darn.
As I was sort of hoping we might.
Well.
Yeah, I know. In any event, we've got some brighter Trump-related accountability news for you also today. Peter Navarro, a Donald Trump advisor, sentenced to 4 months in federal prison this year following his conviction for defying subpoenas from the U.S. House and their January 6th committee, must report to federal prison in Miami next week after a panel of federal appeals court judges rejected his bid to put his sentence on hold while he continues his appeal. Three federal appeals court judges ruled that Navarro had, quote, not shown that his appeal presents substantial questions of law or fact likely to result in reversal or a new trial, or a sentence that does not include a term of imprisonment or a reduced sentence of imprisonment that is less than the expected duration of the appeal process. Navarro's lawyers previously indicated they would seek to take their case to the Supreme Court. All right. And normally I would say something snarky like, yeah, well, good luck with that. But with this Supreme Court, we'll see.
Well, at least Peter Navarro at this point is going to jail.
Unless the Supreme Court steps in.
True.
But they're going to have to do so soon because he's supposed to report on Tuesday. Navarro was directed to report in Miami on Tuesday, March 19 by 2 p.m. He played a key role, of course, in Trump's failed efforts to steal the 2020 election by, among other things, promoting false claims of mass voter fraud. He was subpoenaed by the January 6th committee in February of 2022, but he refused to provide testimony or the documents they requested. Navarro has said he couldn't cooperate with the committee. He really wanted to, but he couldn't because Trump had invoked executive privilege, preventing him from doing so. But U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta barred that argument at trial because he found that Navarro showed no evidence to demonstrate that Trump had actually ever invoked executive privilege, even as, by the way, Trump was out of office by that time and actually had no authority to invoke executive privilege on his own. Now, as with the disgraced former White House aide, Steve Bannon, The House January 6th committee referred the matter to the Department of Justice because Steve Bannon also refused to respond to these subpoenas. So they referred the matter to the DOJ. They filed charges of criminal contempt against both men. Bannon was also sentenced to 4 months in prison under a different judge. So he has, Bannon has so far, thanks to that different judge in his case, he so far has managed to stay out of prison pending his appeal somehow. Navarro does not look like he will be quite as lucky. Federal prosecutors said ahead of Navarro's sentencing that, quote, like the rioters at the Capitol, Navarro put politics, not country, first and stonewalled Congress's investigation and chose allegiance to former President Donald Trump over the rule of law. You are not a victim, Judge Mehta told Navarro at his sentencing back in January. You are not the object of political prosecution. You have received every process you are due. And finally, back over the pond again for this one that I've been trying to get to all week. This one has sort of slipped through the cracks, I guess, because Donald Trump, you know, keeps losing in court so much when he actually goes to trial that when it only cost him about $400,000, it's no longer newsworthy at that point. Oh, it's only $400,000. It's below $500,000. So who cares? Anyway, according to AP, the disgraced former president has been ordered to pay a six-figure legal bill to a company founded by a former British spy that he unsuccessfully sued for making what Trump's lawyers called, quote, shocking and scandalous false claims that harmed Trump's reputation. How you can harm Trump's reputation at this point is beyond me. But a London judge who threw out the case against Orbis Business Intelligence last month said that it was, quote, bound to fail, ordered Trump to pay legal fees of some £300,000. That's about $382,000. Orbis Business Intelligence was the company founded by Christopher Steele, who once ran the Russia desk for Britain's secret intelligence service known as MI6. The British court case was one of few, AP notes, in which Trump was not a defendant as he faces massive legal problems back at home. And yet he still found a way to lose this case anyway. He wasn't even the defendant, and he still lost it and owes a whole bunch of money. The so-called Steele dossier, which was assembled in 2016, it was paid for by both Democratic and Republican opponents of Trump that year. It included salacious allegations Russians could potentially use to blackmail Trump, and it created a political storm after Trump's election. No, it was not used to keep him from winning the presidency. It didn't come out until after the election, but just before his inauguration. It included rumors and uncorroborated allegations. Trump sued the company after leaving office, saying the dossier was phony, and that Orbis had violated British data protection laws, and that the former president, quote, suffered personal and reputational damage and distress over claims in the dossier that he had taken part in, quote, sex parties in St. Petersburg and consorted with sex workers in Moscow. Steele's company, Orbis, said the lawsuit should be thrown out because the report was never meant to be public and was published by BuzzFeed without the permission of Steele or Orbis. Judge Karen Stein sided with the company and with Steele, and now Trump will have to pay attorney's fees to both Orbis and Steele for that frivolous suit as well. And I say as well, and if some of this sounds familiar to you, it might be because also in 2022, a U.S. federal judge down in Florida also dismissed a similar Trump lawsuit against Christopher Steele and against 2016 Democratic rival Hillary Clinton and against former top FBI officials. The judge rejected his claims that they all helped concoct the Russia investigation that overshadowed much of his administration. And I might add, overshadowed it for very good reason, given what we have learned throughout his administration and in the years following it. Disagree? Sue me, Trump. Green News Report is next. I'm Brad Friedman. You're listening to The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. I'll stop Busy news day for a change. You should hear all the stories I had to throw out just to get to the ones we didn't throw out.
Yeah, just so much.
Those were the really good ones. Sorry, you'll have to tune in another day. Until then, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
We have seen record-shattering heat.
Florida Republicans ban local efforts to protect outdoor workers from heat exposure. Fossil fuel industry still not plugging climate warming methane leaks. Plus, California snowpack is back.
Yay!
But not enough to help struggling salmon.
Boo. All of those complaints and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We are no longer energy independent or energy dominant, as we were just a few short years ago.
That's not true. None of those things. It's all a lie. Are you trying to hypnotize those people? Because I think it's working. This is your Green News Report.
Saudi Arabia and Russia will repeat your...
Okay, Desi Doyen, boy, down in Florida where they really, really hate big government. They sure have a funny way of showing it these days.
Yes, they do. In the wake of Florida's hottest year on record last year, the Republican-controlled state legislature this week passed legislation prohibiting cities and counties from adopting any ordinances requiring protection for workers from extreme heat, like mandatory water breaks and shade protections for construction and agriculture workers.
They're blocking small local government from doing what they want to help their citizens.
Exactly. After intense pressure from industry, the fast-tracked bill preemptively bans local workplace protections against heat and renders current local protections void and prohibited as of July 1st. The bill is now headed to Republican Governor Ron DeSantis's desk. With heat-related deaths on the rise in Florida, labor advocates, of course, condemned the new law. Here's Esteban Wood, policy director for We Count, an immigrant worker advocacy group, in an interview with WLRN.
It is absolutely asinine that we have legislators in Tallahassee dictating what local communities should be deciding in their own backyards.
Because Tallahassee and the Republicans that run it, including Ron DeSantis, don't give a damn about big government or the residents of Florida.
In other news, levels of climate warming methane released by the fossil fuel industry rose to near record highs in 2023, despite technology available to curb methane pollution at virtually no cost. The International Energy Agency's Global Methane Tracker report, out this week, warns that global oil, gas, and coal producers' failure to plug leaks and reduce methane emissions directly jeopardizes global efforts to limit global warming. The IEA says the fossil fuel industry must cut methane emissions 75% by 2030 to be on track for net zero emissions in 2050 and can do so with existing cheap technology. In related news, the state of Texas on Friday sued the Biden administration to block new Environmental Protection Agency rules that curb methane emissions from the fossil fuel industry.
We'd hate to inconvenience anyone in the fossil fuel industry, wouldn't we?
In politics, far-right Republicans have a plan for the next Republican president to withdraw the United States from the voluntary UN Paris Climate Agreement. Again, as climate science denier and ex-President Donald Trump did in his first term. Project 2025, the massive policy roadmap crafted by Republicans for the next Republican president, would also withdraw the U.S. entirely from the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and prevent the next Democratic president from re-entering the Paris Agreement, which President Joe Biden did when he took office in 2021. Critics say another withdrawal would harm U.S. standing with global partners and would have serious ramifications on a whole host of international issues beyond climate change.
Yep,
Meanwhile, in California, the good news is that recent major winter storms have recharged the state's vital mountain snowpack. Not as much as last year, only at 80% of average now, but enough that officials say that the state may avoid drought in 2024. However, the storms came too late for California's salmon populations, which have been decimated by years of drought. Fisheries managers last week announced they will likely curtail or outright ban commercial and recreational salmon fishing again this year after canceling the entire season for the first time ever last year to give the fish populations more time to recover. And finally, good news in the UK. In 2023, the UK's greenhouse gas emissions fell to their lowest level since 1879,
really?
According to a new analysis by climate data firm Carbon Brief. The drop was due partly to the UK closing all but one of its coal plants, the growth in renewable energy and electrification, and a big drop in demand for natural gas, thanks to above-average temperatures.
Thanks, Above Average Temperatures. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I said it's getting hot in here, so, hot. So take off all your clothes.
I am getting so hot, I want
to take my All right, thank you very much, Desi. Boy, I tell you what. You get a lot of news for your money on this show. That's all I'm saying. A whole lot.
Well, I hope so.
I hope so. By the way, you had a point we weren't able to fit into that story in
yes.
Florida, that maddening story where the Republicans down there are trying to make it unlawful for towns and cities to make sure their workers in their cities stay safe when
yes.
they get this record heat.
Now, this was something that grist.org, a great environmental website, nonprofit, they made a really striking observation that
yeah.
I had not seen,
mm-hmm.
but they said that extreme heat affects everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But in Florida, the hottest state in the country, only one group is legally protected. That is student athletes, not construction workers, not farm workers.
There you go.
Just student athletes.
Well,
and for good reason.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic and harrowing story to read. But I think they make an excellent point that, you know, they only have the one group that they care about.
Oh, but, yeah.
Republicans.
Take care of those athletes. Everyone else can go to hell.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, you can download them all for free at bradblog.com. Share them with your friends, your family, your friends, your enemies, everyone else. That is made possible, thankfully, by those of you who stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. It's greatly appreciated. We cannot do it without you. Bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Oh, it's getting hot.